I want to welcome everyone to our Keeping on Track open line. We're celebrating at Lighthouse 23 years in business and just entering our 10th year of doing open lines. We have a few exciting new changes. First, we have a new 2017 open line format that comes with the launching of our new website. It's a very cool website if you haven't seen it yet. You can also find an archive of past topics on the publication event tab, and we've covered just about every topic you can imagine, and whether it's publication or the open line program, so please feel free to browse around that. Our second book, Cracking the Business Code, is available on Amazon, or you can click on the book icon on the homepage and get a copy for yourself. Plus, in 2018, there's our visionary planning, Steve. We'll have our third book out, which is Cracking the Team Building Code, and it'll be available first quarter of next year. And we are currently, we just started offering skills testing, and you can find that on our homepage also. If you'd like more information, just email me around that or email us. For those that work with Lighthouse, you might have met Glenn Croy already, who is our new senior consultant and COO for Lighthouse. Glenn has been a CEO for companies with several hundred employees with a strong OD background, and we're so glad to have Glenn on our team. Our topic today is working with your team in our economy and planning for the future. My name is Dana Barocca. I'm the CEO of Lighthouse Consulting Services. We'll all be hosting our program today. We have a few housekeeping items, and we're going to jump right into our topic. For those of you joining us for the very first time at Lighthouse, everything we do goes back to our mission statement, bringing effective insight to your organization. We do this through our in-depth work style and personality assessments to raise the hiring bar and assist companies with a variety of services, including team building, stress management workshops, and much, much more. We have an office in Taiwan, so if you have an operation in Asia and would like to get leadership coaching for them or providing ideas of how to best interact with a U.S. company, just let us know. Our goal is to make this an interactive program. So on your screen, you'll see an area you can send questions or ideas during our discussion, and we'll attempt to respond to as many of you as possible. So, or you can write down two or three questions during our program, and we're going to be opening up the line at the very end so you can talk with Steve. It's a privilege to have Steve Phillips on Open Line again. Steve is a longtime friend, and he is just amazing. And you're going to get so much out of this program today. Steve has a PhD and has a unique method for preparing teams for the future and specializes in offsites for senior leadership. Some of his clients include Microsoft, PepsiCo, Viacom, Mattel, and Boeing, as well as many smaller companies looking to develop their senior leadership and to grow the organization. He's the author of many books, including the Team Building Sourcebook, Team Building for the Future, Beyond Basics, and Team Training, From Startup to High Performance. Those are just a few of the many books Steve has written. Steve also has served on the faculties of Purdue University, San Diego State University, Pepperdine, and the University of Southern California. And for those of you that are part of UCLA, we love Steve. Okay? No putting notes up around Bruins. I just feel so privileged to have Steve with us today, and the ideas that he's going to be sharing is going to help each of us in preparing for the future and for dealing with today's business issues. Also, registration for our next program will begin at the end of this program. The topic will be redesigning performance appraisals for today's organizations. Steve, welcome back to Open Line.
Thank you, Dana. I'm very happy to be here. Hey, and congratulations on your 23 years at Lighthouse and your 10 years at Open Line. I think that's fantastic.
Thank you.
And hello, everybody. Nice to be back. I'm happy to talk to you about teams and planning for the future. And just one quick comment. Yes, I went to USC and I'm a Trojan, but I was brought up in Westwood playing at UCLA. So as long as UCLA is playing anybody else but USC, I'm a giant Bruin fan. So don't hate me. And for all of you Trojans out there, go Trojans. Okay, here we go. I just want to start off with a couple things. Dana, thank you for that nice introduction. And I just want to come clean right away, guys. I have some biases and I have some contentions. questions, and I'd like to get these out first, and then we'll talk about the teams. One of my first contentions is that people are hard. People are hard, and I think they're probably the hardest part of business. And I used to joke around and say, boy, if you could just get rid of all of our employees and all of our customers, wouldn't business be so much easier? So first thing I'm going to start with is I think people are the hardest part of business. I don't think business is that tough. People can be very frustrating. The second thing is it shows in the research, and I've seen it over and over and over again, that teams consistently outperform individuals on complex tasks. And I don't know anything these days that's not a complex task in business. So really having a highly effective, high-performing team makes a huge difference. And the last thing that I'd like to just get off my chest and tell you it's one of my biases is I believe, and most people miss this when it comes to teams, that being really tough and mastering team process is a key to really getting the most out of your teams. Most people don't pay a lot of attention to process. They pay a lot of attention to people. They pay a lot of attention to the task at hand. But I honestly believe after 30 years of working with teams that truly and deeply understanding team process, different types of process, where you are in any given process, and then leading or facilitating a team to that process makes a giant difference. So with that, let's just jump in, and I think we'll get started. I think I'm in charge of the slides here. Let me see if I can move that first one. Here we go.
Perfect.
Got it. Okay, so.
It'll take a second to catch up. Not move. There we go.
I think I need one more, Dana, because I have something about performance appraisals up right now.
Right now it says key job of any top team member.
Okay, well, that's exactly the slide I want. That's not what I have up in front of me.
Okay. Maybe just go with that slide and tell me and I'll advance when we get to the...
Okay. Okay. So, key job of any top team, right? That's where we are. So,
yes.
Okay. On this, I wanted to separate out top teams from other sorts of teams because I think they have different requirements, different pressures. And we will drop away from top teams in just a minute, but I didn't want to leave this without going there. And I think one of the things about top teams is they are very exposed to the environment, where a lot of the teams deeper in the organizations are not. They're also hugely exposed to very difficult politics, where other teams are not necessarily. And so I think they have a somewhat of a unique set of circumstances. And one of the jobs, I think, of any top team is to really do that strategic planning, Dana, that you and I were talking about earlier, different than operational planning, and then they drop into operational planning. And when I talk about seeing alternative futures clearly, I have been shocked and dismayed and thrilled all at the same time when I work with senior teams around looking into the future. And one of the things that has been so surprising to me is how much people actually agree when you use a structured process what the most probable future will look like. And the way I like to go about that is to have the team members project out into a given time frame, 3 years, 2 years, 5 years, whatever it is, let's just agree on a time frame, and then look at political variables, technical variables, social variables, and financial variables. Let's look at the politics, okay? So we just have now a new administration. We can probably predict in general what direction that new administration is going to take in terms of business policies. If you're in between cycles and you might be doing this with a team and the election's coming up, I did it with one group in a construction industry where if it went Republican, there we had a one set of assumptions. If it went Democratic, we had another. And so we had alternative futures branching out in two different directions because of that. Technically, you always want to look at the latest technical advances. I'm working with a drone company right now. It is absolutely fascinating what the new technology around drones is. If you're aware of what's going on out there, that won't be any surprise to you, but drones are already delivering packages for Amazon. They're dropping off pizzas. They're flying in formations of 30 and 40 to do jobs. And there is absolutely no regulations around drones at the moment. And that is what people are working to do. And so knowing that drones can affect your business, technically things like e-retailing has killed retailers out there with what Amazon is doing. Knowing how technology is going to impact your industry and projecting that out for a couple years, very powerful. Socially, in terms of things like we're now pretty used to the millennials and we know how to organize and structure for millennials, but 5 or 6 years ago, we did not know how to do that. I worked extensively with JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, to restructure the lab for millennials. Sometimes social things make a huge difference to what we're going to be able to do at work or not do. And then financially, of course, as Dana and I were talking about earlier, if a recession is coming or if a boom is coming, being able to adjust accordingly. So being able to project out into the future with your team and then coming up with what you think is the most probable future. So you talk about all these categories, you talk about alternative futures, and the thing that's been amazing to me is how much agreement there actually is when you use a structured process for what the future is going to look like. So if you can get to that agreement, then you can position your company where you want it to be in that future. Do you want to be on the bleeding edge? Do you want to be on the leading edge? Do you want to be right behind the leading edge? Do you want to be in the middle of the pack? Do you want to be at the bottom picking up the crumbs in a maturing industry? All of those are fine. You can make money in all of those positions. Each of those has different implications. So kind of getting all of that set out on the top of the organization, finding the right future, positioning yourself into that future, and then dropping down into operational plans and doing all the stuff that we know how to do with most teams in terms of having a really clear mission and purpose, and then creating strategic initiatives and metrics and projects and action plans and so forth. So I think any team needs to do planning. I think top teams in particular need to do the strategic planning and the operational planning. Dana, if you can move that next slide.
A question just came in. How long is a session like that? Is that a weekend or a week or a what kind of time should you put aside?
And is that, Dana, for the alternative futures and positioning, or is it for the whole thing? I can answer for both if you don't know.
Whole thing.
Okay, well, usually I can do all of that in a two-day retreat, and it's a long two-day retreat. If you had 2.5 days, it would be better because I like to have downtime with my teams. We'll talk about that in a little while. Teams actually perform better when they spend time together not working. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but it's really true. So most of the senior leadership retreats I do are 2 days. If I can start with a dinner the night before and we can get some of the logistics out of the way in that dinner and then have a full 2 days, that makes it much, much, much better. So I would say a full 2 days is minimum to get all of that done. Usually you can do just planning in probably a day and a half, but I like to do planning and team development together. It makes a beautiful package, and that's what takes 2 to 2.5 days.
And Steve, one more question before we move to the next slide. How about follow-up to that? Is it quarterly or?
Yes, it is. The right follow-up, and I say right in quotation marks, is to do a strategic follow-up every quarter, and most of my clients agree, and very few of them do it. They think it's just too much time. But the truth of the matter is, for me, is that my clients that do that seriously outperform everybody else for two main reasons. One is that they stay dedicated to their strategy, and they adjust their strategy before anything goes terribly wrong. So the point of a update and follow-up meetings is to check in on strategy, which is an accountability process. We'll talk about that in a minute, to adjust strategy based upon the new information we're learning, and to keep the team clean and whole. Nothing terrible can happen on a team in a quarter. But if you let it go two quarters, you can lose trust, you can get way off track, you can have interpersonal issues, you can have role issues. So I'm a big believer in meeting quarterly just for strategic purposes, and the better you get at it, the less time it takes. And when I work with a client for a year or two, by the second year, we have dialed in that follow-up process, so it's only a half day. And it's a wonderful half day. We get to do team development as well as strategy adjustment.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Move us forward to the next slide.
Okay.
Key job of any team.
And
yes.
Dana, just so you know, I do not have the slides in front of me. I think I probably hit the wrong button somewhere.
Okay.
Okay. So key job of any team. Well, I think knowing your purpose is extremely important, and people forget their purpose. And teams can have different purpose. So some teams are a leader, like a natural work team. They're a leader in their direct reports. And sometimes those direct reports are all doing the same job, and sometimes they're all doing very different jobs. So they're like a cross-functional team. But having a really clean purpose, coming back to your purpose, and like Dana, you said, everything comes back to the mission statement for you at Lighthouse, I think that's really critical. And people tend to forget about their purpose, and they tend to just keep doing their work. So knowing your purpose and staying on purpose and helping people understand their purpose, very important. And there's a couple things about purpose, and the same thing with the next bullet about envisioning the outcome of your work and your team relationships. The newer organizations these days don't just have a profit purpose. They often have a cause purpose as well. And so knowing that you can have multiple purposes, is that a purpie? You can have that, and that's okay. At a very minimum, however, when you are working with your team, you should recognize that you have a task outcome and a relationship outcome. And many people don't recognize the relationship outcome, and they just feel like what their team is trying to do is accomplish a task. And in my book, it's both. The relationships are what makes the team work, and also you want good relationships so that when your team disbands, everybody is still loving each other and wanting to work with each other. It just helps all the way around. And then I think every team needs to create and track against a plan, and create, implement, and track. And it's tracking is very, very important. And this is, you asked the follow-up question. Tracking against a plan allows you to have an accountability mechanism, which is very important. I think it's a giant waste of time to have leaders running around holding individuals accountable. I think when you have people issues, you want to find system solutions. So the key phrase on that is system solutions to people problems. And by having a plan with a follow-up every quarter, you are creating a system solution for accountability. Just by having that quarterly meeting and by structuring it appropriately, then you don't have to hold anybody accountable. The system holds people accountable. People will want to do the work before the meeting. They won't want to embarrass themselves in front of their peers. And if you have them do pre-work, then you can actually run these meetings very, very quickly. And then the leader is freed up to do what the leader does best. And usually that's not being a cop and holding people accountable. And then also as a leader, it gives you an opportunity. If there's certain things that are really important, you can call up the people that are responsible for those a week or 10 days or 2 weeks before the meeting and offer your support, offer to remove any roadblocks, put your energy against their outcomes. That usually helps them get through it and do it successfully. And then you're not only supporting people, but you're ensuring the outcome that you're looking for as well in a very positive way.
Ooh, that's good.
Dana, can you flip the next one, please?
Yep. Get the right people on the team and move off the wrong people.
Very, very, very important. And like I said, I think people are the hardest part of business. And I think developing a team, well, let me put it differently. creating a team from scratch is hard enough and a very specific skill set. I've hired many senior executives who say they've done this, but when I actually push them on it, they haven't. They've inherited teams. Creating a team is one thing, and I think it's actually easier to create a team than it is to inherit a team. I've built two homes now from scratch, and the home I'm currently in, I am currently remodeling, and I find remodeling much more difficult than building from scratch. And it's hard when you have to remodel, and I believe it's the same thing with teams, is that if you can build your own team, you can draft the right players. You can find the people that are energized and motivated and competent and clear and trustworthy and smart. But when you inherit a team, it takes time to figure everybody out. Not everybody is an A player. Sometimes the team has a set of norms that are dysfunctional, but they work for the team. And so I think you've got to take some time to get to know your team players, to understand the experiences. And then the hard part is to move people off the team that are not the A player. And I know that sounds terrible and it sounds harsh, but it enlightens the team, because if the person's not a great player, they're holding back the rest of the team, and all the team players know it. And even though it's a tough conversation, it's developmental for the person, and it's good for the team.
Steve, a question just came in on this topic. Does what you're talking about apply to grassroots level people, so outside of the senior team?
Yes, I'm talking about everybody now. And if you've got a natural work team and you've inherited your employees, okay, that's fine. Most of us are okay with C players and B players. I particularly like A players for the most part. It doesn't matter what level. I find B players to be the most difficult. When you have somebody who's not great, it's easy to move them off. When you have somebody that contributes but just doesn't contribute all the way, then they're secretly hurting your team. So when you have a B player, they do enough that you don't really have any reason to fire them. You just know they're not doing as much as they could. And I don't necessarily mean fire. I mean move off the team. But yes, this is all teams everywhere, whether it's a sports team or a family team or a business team, and a business team at any level.
That's a good analogy with a sports team. Can a team afford to have baseball, football, hockey, can they afford to have a C player on their team? The answer is no.
Well, they can afford it. They just won't win the championship.
There you go. Okay. There you go.
Yeah. So I think it's a really good analogy. And most team leaders I know don't want to move people off their teams, don't want to make the hard decisions, don't want to have the crucial conversations. But the higher up in the organization you get, the more experience you get, it doesn't necessarily make those movements easier, but generally the people are more mature, they know they need to do it, and they step in and they do it. And it's tough, but it makes a huge difference, absolutely a huge difference. It's actually good for the team players, the team leader. It's good for the people you move off the team, even though it doesn't seem like it. When you really talk to them later, they'll say you did them a giant favor. So if you could flip over to the next slide, Dana.
Okay, the next slide is clarify roles.
And once you get into having your plan, getting your right team players, now there's certain things you can do on the team itself to get the team up to high performance very quickly. I don't like to go in and mess around with roles unless there are problems, but you'll hear about the problems if there are. So role clarification is very easy. It's those three questions on the slide: who's responsible, what do they need from others to do their jobs, and what do others need from them. But the complaints you'll hear is, I thought that was my job. Somebody else will say, I thought that was my job, and then they'll be in conflict and they'll clash if the roles overlap too much. If the roles don't overlap enough, things will fall through the cracks, And then people say, I thought you were going to do that. I thought you were going to do that. And then the team ends up in crisis all the time, cleaning up all the things that went wrong that nobody knew they were supposed to take care of. So role clarification is not hard if you think you need to do it. You just have people write down their roles and share them with everybody else, and everybody else says what they need from the person, and the person says what they need from everybody else. And most of the misunderstandings just fall away. And I would say over 90% of the time, the only issue is a misunderstanding. 10% of the time, there is a true systemic issue, and the boss needs to be in the room and make a judgment call. Yes, person A, that is your job. No, person B, that's not your job. Or, hey, person A, include tasks 1, 2, and 3 in your role because it's falling through the cracks and we need you to do that. But the trickiest part on roles, and I definitely want to talk about this for a second, is when you get savvy people and they misdiagnose a problem, and what they'll say is, it's a role problem, it's a role problem, we have a problem with roles. So when I go in and interview people before we get to do our team development work, people, I will ask about roles, and sometimes people say the roles are clear, and sometimes they say they're not. And when they say they're not clear, and I get several people on the team saying they're not clear, then we tend to put it on the agenda for the team building and strategic planning session. And what I have found is that people will often say the role is not clear when the reality is they just don't like it. So they'll tend to say the roles aren't clear. We'll work the role clarification. The roles actually are crystal clear. But people can keep saying it's not clear because you can always keep splitting hairs. And they just split another hair and split another hair and split another hair, and they keep saying, well, it's not clear, it's not clear. And after a while, you go, you know what? It is so clear, it's ridiculous. You just don't like your job. And that's a very different problem. So when you have a role clarification issue, you can clear it up with the team pretty quickly. When you have somebody who doesn't like their role, that's a leadership problem. And the solution set is completely different for somebody who doesn't like their role than when the roles aren't clear. But I think it's something to really take into account as a leader of a team, and when you're running a high-performance team, to just make sure the roles are clean, the roles are clear, everybody knows what they're supposed to do, everybody gets what they need from each other. Because if you don't do that, then it starts to erode trust. And we're going to get to trust in just a minute, because as a matter of fact, why don't you flip to the next slide.
Okay, and Steve, how often should the manager or whoever it is review their goals and objectives with them, or quote, job description? Is it quarterly or once a year? Or
no, it really does depend on your team. So let's just take it as a natural work team. So you're the boss and these people report to you. I would say at an opportunity to do your planning process, do planning and team development together. And it's at that point that you want to check in on the critical variables for teams, roles, goals, relationships, processes and procedures, and leadership, and also set your operational plans in place. And then the other time, if you have a task team or a project team working on something, it's just at the very beginning. Unless, as a leader, you're hearing complaints, and the complaints sound like the roles are clashing or they're not overlapping enough. So once a year is plenty, and I probably wouldn't even do it that often unless there was complaints about it.
Okay.
And with
okay.
new teams, absolutely do it right away and then check in on it maybe 4 months to 6 months later just to make sure everybody's okay.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Slide is get to know your team members and proactively work to build trust.
Yes. So trust can absolutely kill a team. If you do not have trust, this is one of the biggest issues that will keep you from being a high-performance team. And so many things can go wrong when trust is not proactively created. And I've been doing a fair amount of work just this year on trust alone because several of my clients have called me with very difficult trust problems, and I've started to change my thinking on trust. So we all know that there's different characteristics on trust, things like character and consistency and competence and critique, the four C's that make up trust. Some people trust people right away until they prove untrustworthy. trustworthy. Some people don't trust people at all until they earn the person's trust. And it's just tricky. I'm sorry, Dana, go ahead.
Oh, Steve, could you repeat the four C's so everybody can write those down?
Yes. It's character. So you can, somebody may have bad character and you just don't trust them as a person. On the other hand, they could have good character, but they may have poor competence. So character and competence. Competence is, can they do the job? So they could be a great person but not have any competence, and you don't trust them to do the job. Or they could be, have competence, but you don't trust their character. Another one is consistency. So, you need to be able to predict what people are going to do. If the person's going to be late and they're always going to be late, they're at least consistent about it. So if somebody's inconsistent, it's very difficult to predict them, which means it's very difficult to trust them. And the last one is critique. Nobody likes to be critiqued all the time. So if somebody is critiquing every single move you make, every single thing you do, and you're walking on eggshells around them, that tends to destroy trust as well. So what I've been thinking about lately with trust is that it's almost a two-factor scale of negative 100 to 0 and 0 to positive 100. This is similar to Hertzberg's two-factor theory of motivation. And when you've got significant distrust on a team, then you have to dissipate that distrust and get it to neutral before you can start building trust. And trust is a really difficult concept to grasp, because you can trust somebody, you're in a relationship with somebody, and you've been in the relationship for 20 years, and then the person cheats on you, you lose trust in that person. You lose 20 years of trust in one moment. And it's like, okay, but how do you gain back that trust? Gaining back trust is seriously hard. And so the notion on this is, if you really want a high-performance team, you have to proactively work trust. You have to get to know people. You have to put inside of your team processes starter questions like, what's your favorite activity out of work, or what's a big hobby that you have, or what's something about you that none of us would know that would be interesting to know? You could do style assessments. There's a million style assessments out there, the DISC, the social styles, learning styles, the Myers-Briggs. Just have fun, conflict styles. Just do style assessments for a little bit of time before your meetings and get to know each person. Spend time with your people. Have them spend time with each other. Those sorts of things are invaluable for when problems happen later. When you have a trusting team, people tend to give each other the benefit of the doubt. They tend to get each other's back. They tend to offer up solution sets to each other when they're needed. But when you have a team that doesn't have trust, it's very difficult to get stuff done. Everybody looks out for themselves. They only do just enough. And the team really doesn't gain the synergy that you would like. So the bottom line for me is kind of discovering and learning the emotional makeup of your teammates. What really makes up their emotional set? And then working with that emotional set to kind of give them what they need and support them, and have all team members really spend time getting to know each other. There's a great deal of research that suggests it's a great way to go. It's a little bit of counterintuitive for people, because they think spending time like that is actually wasting time because they're not working on a task. But it's very important to work the relationship side of teams as well as the task side of teams. Can we flip over to the next slide, Dana?
We have about 15 minutes, so I just want to...
Okay, great.
So the next slide, build a set of explicit team ground rules.
Yes, okay. So this is a proactive approach to high-performance teams as well. And if everybody could just play a thought experiment game with me, if you don't mind. In your mind right now, I want everybody to think of a dog, a very specific dog, a dog that you actually know. Think of a dog. Go ahead and get one in your brain. And once you do that, if we were all together, I would ask you for all the different types of dogs, but since it's a one-way call, I would just suggest that we probably have everything in your heads, from a little tiny Chihuahua to a middle-range Spaniel to maybe a Shepherd or Golden Retriever or Labrador, all the way up to some giant dog like a Great Dane. And that's a very common thing, that when I say think of a dog, that you'll get a dog in your head and it'll be a very clear, clean picture of a dog. The same thing happens with team. When you say, all right, think of a team, or now you're on a team, the same construct happens. People get different pictures in their heads for what that means. And also what goes with those pictures is the care and feeding of a Chihuahua is radically different than the care and feeding of a working dog that has to run for 2 hours a day, or the care and feeding of a Great Dane who needs to eat 5 pounds of food a day. And it's the same thing with teams. Different teams have different care and feeding. And what happens so often is that people believe the picture in their head is the same picture that everybody has. And so the care and feeding for their Chihuahua in their head, they're acting that way on the team, where somebody else's care and feeding for the Great Dane is completely different, and they're acting that way on their team. So the idea with team ground rules is to make the rules of the team explicit rather than implicit. Not all teams are the same, and not all people think the same way about the way to play on a team. So by being proactive and putting a set of ground rules in place, then everybody knows the rules of the game. And the ground rules can be a very powerful tool for keeping the team efficient, for dealing with conflict. Very similar to when you fight with your spouse and it's very difficult to get out of the fight while you're fighting. You end up in marriage counseling, and what the marriage counselor will tell you is, hey, let's create ground rules for when we fight while we are not fighting. And then you create the ground rules with the therapist, and then you go back, and the next time you have a fight with your spouse, if you follow those ground rules, you tend to get to resolve very easily. But it's very difficult to get there without the ground rules. So having really good ground rules up front is a very, very helpful process for team effectiveness. Now, the first set of ground rules that teams tend to create are usually in opposition to bad behavior. So the meetings start late, and people interrupt each other, and everybody talks on top of each other. And so they set ground rules that sound like, okay, let's start meetings on time, let's end meetings on time, let's have one person talk at a time, stuff like that. Those are okay ground rules, but those are just to get you to neutral. So I strongly suggest that if you've never set ground rules before, do it the first time and then redo it maybe 6 months later, 4 to 6 months later, because the second set of ground rules is usually aspirational. There are things like play all out, bring your A game, assume best intentions of others, go directly to the person if you have conflict with the person and work it out. Things like that. And when you have really A-player ground rules and people follow those ground rules because they're committed to them and they've created them, teams tend to run much more effectively. So a lot of times, set a set of ground rules and work for a while, and then people will start to violate them just because they forget about them, reset them, and then bring them up for 2 or 3 meetings in a row and put them on little cards and give them to people and remind the team every once in a while, and the teams tend to operate much more effectively. Can you flip over, Dana?
Right. Yes. Great idea.
Dial in your team processes.
That's it.
Okay, this, as I said in the very beginning, mastering team process is, I think, probably the biggest, most powerful way to run highly effective teams, and most people don't have a clue. They understand a process here or there, but you can really go to school on team processes. And something that we learned out of the quality movement in the 80s, believe it or not, was that disciplined processes breed freedom. Disciplined processes breed freedom. If you don't ever have to think about your processes because they're effective, you have lots of time to do everything else. And I think one of the really funny examples of this was Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs did a lot of things really well and a lot of things horrifically bad. But one of the things, you know, if anybody ever followed Steve, you knew that he wore the same exact outfit every day. Think about if you know what it is. Most people do. He wore jeans and a black turtleneck. And when asked, why does he wear jeans and a black turtleneck? I actually saw an interview with him where they showed his closet with like 30 pair of jeans and 30 black turtlenecks. He said because he never, ever had to give any mind share to what he was going to wear, ever. He wanted to use all of that mind power on everything else. And I think that's a very strong parallel to team processes. But unfortunately, team processes are much more complex than just wearing a pair of jeans and having a black turtleneck. So there are processes for your meetings, like how often and how long and what's the agenda and, you know, who's going to come, things like that. Decision-making processes, you know, are we consensus? Are we leader-led decision? Are we using the DCIF process? Who's a decision maker? Who needs to be consulted before a decision? Who needs to be informed after the decision? And who should facilitate the decision-making process? Or is it going to be a vote? You know, whatever it is, it should just be very clean and called out so that we all know what it is. But then there's a lot of other smaller team processes that I think make a huge difference. And one of the statements, and Dana, thank you for calling out my PhD. It's actually a dual degree. I have one in communication and one in organizational behavior. And all my communication stuff, I have, I just love communication. And one of my sayings is, I always know where I am in any communication situation. I always know where I am in any communication situation. What that means is if we're doing problem solving is usually a 5 or 7 step process. You know, you have to define what the problem is and define what it isn't. You generally should create criteria for any solution set. You might want to do a root cause analysis. You might want to create alternative solutions and then weigh those alternative solutions against your criteria and then pick one and think about implications. That's all different steps in the problem-solving process. But people will say things like, hey, let's brainstorm this. And they don't even know the rules of brainstorming. So brainstorming is an idea generation technique. All that it's good for is creating ideas. And if you do it right, you'll create hundreds and hundreds of ideas. Most people don't even follow the rules. Other types of communication, like a discussion or information gathering, or a dialogue, those are very different. They have different rules and they have different processes. A discussion drills down to a common denominator. A dialogue builds up to a new understanding. There's a different process for discussion than there is for dialogue. Same thing with information gathering or information giving. There are different processes for those things. So as facilitators, we often use the parking lot when somebody goes off process. We want to acknowledge what they said. We want to capture it so that they can relax and continue to do what we want them to do. So we take their notion and we put it on a parking lot and we come back to it later. Understanding process and sticking to it makes a giant difference on the effectiveness of your teams. And most people just don't pay attention to the process enough. And so what happens is teams end up talking about processes a lot, and it really doesn't make any sense. Let's just take a conflict, for example. When you just have a conflict on a team and you're trying to figure it out, some people will yell out causes of the conflict. Well, I think that's because of this, and I think we're doing that because of this. And somebody else will yell out a solution right after that. And somebody will say, well, I think we should go this direction. Well, because of that, I think we should do this thing over here. And somebody else will be trying to analyze it. And they'll be saying, well, is this a value conflict, or is this a real issue? Is this a personality conflict? What's going on here? And so there's no real process discipline in that, and people are all over the place. But if you understand how to take something apart, how to use a clean and clear process, and then how to lead to that process, you can generally get things done much faster with much better outcomes. So kind of having a sense for team process and dialing it in and focusing on it makes a giant difference. You flip over, Dana?
Somebody asked the question what DCIF stands for. It's on the second bullet point.
Yep, I know what it is. It's a decision-making process. The D is who are the quote-unquote decision makers. Because in a group, sometimes the leader is the only decision maker. Sometimes you sub-team it out to two or three people that will make the decision. So the Ds are the decision makers themselves. And what can happen is you can often say, okay, we've got some big decision to make. Who are the decision makers? And you got 10 people on your team. Three people raise their hand or four people raise their hand. Well, then you say, okay, guys, take it offline, go make a decision and come back and tell us. So the Ds are decision makers. The C is people that need to be consulted before a decision is made. They're not a decision maker, but they have something important to say and they want to be heard. So if in that other example, if you've got 10 people on your team and you find out that there's three big Ds, great. But before you just subcommittee it to them, you say, okay, guys, let's talk about this for 10 minutes. Let's open the floor for 10 minutes. Let's have a dialogue. Anybody who needs that has something to say here, this, in essence, the Cs, go ahead, speak up. Let's hear what you got to say. And then you just open the floor, and then you close the floor, and then the decision makers go and make their decision. The I's are the people that really don't have anything to say before the decision is made, and they're not the decision makers, but they need to be informed after the decision is made because it may impact them. So they don't need to speak up early, but they do need to be told what the decision is. And the F is the person, is the facilitator, who is in charge of facilitating the decision-making process. Generally, one of the Ds also is the F. So who's going to call that subcommittee meeting? Who's going to make sure it gets done on time? And it's just a facilitator role to make sure decision-making gets done.
Perfect. Thank you for
going
through that. And we're going to be sending out the slides and audio to everyone after the program next couple days. Next slide is Lead with Purpose. And, Steve, we have another 7 minutes or so.
Great. I think we're doing just fine. We're going to get through the next two slides. Leading with purpose is not what it sounds like. So if you look at those three bullets, find your leadership voice. I often talk to people, if they don't have it, they need to do some internal work, intrapersonal work to find their true leadership voice, frame the team in a higher purpose, and then inspire people. And I just want to mention something on the outside of these three things and then come back to these if we have time. But I found at a conference a while back, I was quite embarrassed when I was asked the question, what is the number one predictor of a high-performance team? The number one predictor of a high-performance team. And there's so much fun when I have groups because people yell out all the stuff you would think they would yell out. They yell out leadership or communication or common goals or trust or relationships or whatever it happens to be, you know, compensation, competence. And that's so much fun because I play with them because none of those things are right. Even though they're obvious, they're not right. The number one predictor of a high-performance team is past experience on a high-performance team. So if you've been on a high-performance team in the past, and most of you have, whether it's a family or a sports team or a work team, you know how good it feels. You know what it feels like to be on a high-performance team. It's actually amazing, which also means that if you're on a team right now that's not high-performance, you know it. So the implication of that the number one predictor of a high-performance team is past experience on a high-performance team, the implication to that is if you're on a team right now and it's not high-performance, you need to bring it. You need to call it out. You can't wait around for somebody else to make this team high-performance. You need to do it. And so it's not just formal leadership I'm talking about here. It's also informal leadership. And we all know that the informal communication network and the informal leadership network is often more powerful than the formal leadership network. Think about it this way. If the formal leader says at a team meeting, we're all going to go do X, Y, and Z, and then people walk out of the meeting and say, what the hell is that guy talking about? I'm not doing that. It doesn't get done. So the informal leaders are very important. And so bringing your own ability to lead, whether it's from the front or the back or the middle, to a team makes a giant difference in team performance. And then one last thing I want to say on this is about inspiring people. I got asked many years ago by MGM to do a course on inspiration. How can our leaders be inspirational? And it really threw me because I have lots of stuff on motivation, but not much on inspiration. And I started looking up all the research, and there's very little research on inspiration, actually. And so they mostly say inspiration is when you overcome very difficult obstacles. Things like that is inspiring, or when somebody lives a very inspiring life, they're doing things that are role modeling things for other people. But I would say finding your leading with purpose is actually focusing on the positive. So many of us just are cynical and focus on the negative and find the one thing wrong. And that just chinks away at the team. It just starts to really take chunks away from the team when you really find all the things wrong with the team. But if you can catch people doing things right, if you can leverage people's strengths, if you can compliment people, if you can find similarities between people, if you can encourage people to step up and go beyond what they think is possible, if you can believe in people, all of those things are very inspiring. Not the critic that says, oh, well, you got most of it right, or, oh, gosh, can you just go do this one other thing, or, oh, my God, that's not right, we're not going to use that, or nice try, but we need to take it to another level. That is not inspirational. And, yes, you can inspire by challenging people, but I find on teams, especially longer-term teams, that encouraging people, supporting people, finding their strengths, finding similarities, that's what you really want to be doing to lead with purpose. And Dana, let's flip over to the last slide for the moment.
Sure.
Common roadblocks.
Here we go, common roadblocks and how to lead through them.
Yes. So we talked about lack of trust. That's the number one roadblock I see. And because of that, I strongly suggest proactive behavior to build trust. And remember the two types of people. I can usually split the room. Those that do not trust first until you prove yourself trustworthy, and those that do trust first until you prove yourself untrustworthy. Neither one of those is right. You can often split a room right down the middle, and sometimes you can even split the room East Coast, West Coast. Us West Coast people tend to be more trusting easily. The East Coast people tend to be less trusting until you earn it. That's a giant generality, but I have found it to be somewhat true. So being proactive about trust, very important. The other thing that can nail you on a team is this thing called rugged individualism. People that are so used to doing their own thing, elbowing their way to get ahead, bringing things under their own control, they usually don't play very well in the sandbox with each other. And I find it a beautiful leadership challenge when I get a lot of rugged individuals on a team, because then I have to step up. I can't just lead people. I have to think of these individuals as leaders themselves because they act like leaders. They're very independent. So I have to think of myself as leading leaders. And when I think of it that way, it's actually a ton of fun because these people generally have lots of energy. They have big opinions. They want to do things their own way. And I'll take that all day long and channel that into high performance versus the last bullet, which is apathy. People that just don't care. They have no energy. They just go along and do what they're told. They just do as little as possible to get by. Those people are very difficult to deal with. I'd rather have a bunch of rugged individualists than a bunch of people with apathy. But if you do get people with apathy, you know, I go one-on-one with those folks. I try to sit down with them, find out what their purpose is, reinforce the purpose of the team, see if I can find something that sparks them. Often I can, but sometimes I can't. I think working to try and inspire those people. But if you can flip them out of their blasé-ness, that's fantastic. But if you can't, if they're just dialing it in, they're just doing their job, they're just spending 8 to 5, making their money and going home, and they just don't care that much, those are the people I try to change out. because those apathetic people, your team will never be better than your worst person. And those people, even though they do an okay job, they're your C students, your C-minus students, to me, they really hurt the team. And it tends to get in the way of everybody's energy and drive and motivation. So with those folks, I go one-on-one. I try to flip them. And then if I can't flip them, I work to change them out, if possible.
So all right, Steve, a question came in on that topic. What if the team members are C players? Do you still praise today and fire tomorrow?
I've never heard that phrase, praise today and fire tomorrow. If they're C players, I have a bias. I contradict myself sometimes. The contradiction is it's never too early to fire somebody. And that I don't really mean it. The reason I say it like that is because I was giving a speech to the Harvard Business School, and I was very nervous about it. So I called up a lot of my CEO clients, and I said, hey, give me words of wisdom. Give me little gems. And one of the themes that came out from, 15 of my CEO clients was, hey, you know what? When you get instincts about a person and you think they're not going to make it, don't try and save them. Just get rid of them because your instincts are right. And they've all tried to save people and fix people, and it just doesn't seem to work very often. And often the longer you leave them in place, they tend to poison everything around them. So the little saying, it's never too early to fire somebody, that just is a quip, but it's kind of true. The other side, for me, I'm a developmental person. I believe in people. I think that, you know, if you go one-on-one and you get real authentic and genuine with each other, you risk with each other, sometimes you can really find out what drives the other person, what motivates the other person, and you can create an environment in which they'll be an outstanding player. Now, if you can't do that and you do going to move them on, I'm generally pretty straight with people, and I will give them their strengths and their weaknesses. I'll try to get their agreement about that. I'll try to put development options and plans in place for them, and then, yes, I will continue to encourage them all the way to the point where I move them out. So I find you get better results from people when you are crystal clear and give them the truth. Hey, if you don't step up, this is going to be a problem for us. Here's the places I think you need to step up. Here's the ways I can help you do that. But then if they don't, yes, you still want to praise them for the work they do, because if you come down on them, they will sabotage you, and you don't want that. But I would also tend to be really clear and give them really clear feedback and eventually work them out.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. And I'd like to open it up for any other questions at this point. I know we're probably getting close on time, and then we can go to the very last slide and be done.
Steve, if we could wrap up, and then what I'm going to do is open up the line and people can talk directly.
Then we want me to just do the last slide?
Yeah, let's do the last one, and then we'll...
Words of wisdom. So with words of wisdom and lessons learned, I always like to try and look back on my experiences and all the other experiences with the people I've had. I've kind of been a lifelong learner. I hope all of you are as well. I have messed up a ton in my career, and I'm pretty open about when I mess up. The thing is, however, is that I try to learn, and I want everybody to try and learn as well. As a matter of fact, on teams, I didn't mention it, but it's something called a practice mentality. Oh, here it is. It's the last bullet on this page. So the notion for me is about the practice mentality is that teams, every meeting is a practice for the next meeting. Every time you work with somebody, it's a practice for the next time you work with somebody, in which case you just keep getting better and better and better and better. If you think of everything as a practice to the next thing, and you do a quick, hey, what worked and what didn't work, and the next time you do it, you can even do it better. So I love people that adopt a practice mentality. I think that's a very powerful mental state to have, because it just keeps getting us better and better. I also think team leadership is something to be taken very seriously, and it's not as easy as people think. It's a very specific skill. It takes time to master the skill, and I think you need to bring on your own sense of, hey, I'm a leader of this team, and I need to think about how to lead the team effectively, and you know what? I'm going to keep getting better and better at leading this team. That's something that is not taken for granted, and I think those who can lead teams well have a fantastic tool in their tool belt. Something that's not on this slide is I would really get to work, really work to get to know your people. I am on the Myers-Briggs and INTJ. It goes against my nature to really sit down and talk to people. It's not something I particularly enjoy, but I got really poor results for many years until I went against my own nature and really tried to get to know people. Try to understand their emotional makeup. Spend time with people. Get to know them. Teams are not just about tasks. They're also about relationships. And then if you haven't found your inner leader yet, and if you don't even know what that means, then spend a little time thinking about it. And if you've gone there, if you've gone inside of yourself, if you've done the intrapersonal work to know what you truly believe in, to know what your deepest values are, if you want to really think hard about how you want to be a leader and be seen as a leader, I think it opens up your voice. I think if you can really believe and take a solid stance in who you are, then you have no problem giving your opinion and no problem when people don't take your opinion. But when you're shy and you're afraid to say something and you're not convicted to your own beliefs, then I think you give everybody the chance to run all over you. So do the work, find your inner leader, and don't be afraid to find your voice. And one last bullet would be to go to school on team processes. Information collecting, information gathering, dialogue, discussion, idea generation techniques like brainstorming, root cause analysis, problem solving, decision making, team logistics, running your meetings and having agendas. I think if you focus hard on the processes and get them clean and then lead to those processes and manage against them, I think you'll have a much more efficient and effective team. And always remember, there's the next team meeting. There's the next relationship. Always try to get better. Always try to improve and adopt that practice mentality.
Holy cow. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome, Dana.
My goodness, that was amazing. Also, if anybody is a member of an association and wants a highly energetic speaker that's very knowledgeable and caring and loving and also an outstanding business person, no messing around, Steve does that. We're going to open up the line in just about 30 seconds, but out of respect for comments from the past over the last 10 years, people have asked that we turn off the recording feature before we open up the line and have a discussion. They didn't want their voice recorded, so we want to respect that. Just one more thing here, and then we're going to open the line up for signing up for our next program, which will be on June 22nd, Redesigning Performance Appraisals for Today's Organization. So please sign up for that. And I want to thank Steve from the bottom of my heart for sharing today his wisdom and knowledge that he's gathered over the years. And it's much appreciated from everybody at Lighthouse and especially from me. So big hugs to Steve. So everyone, hold the line. And let me turn the recording feature off, and we'll be right back on. I would ask everyone to please put your phone on mute and then unmute your phone if you have a question for Steve. So we'll be right back.